We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley and Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. How are you today, Bob?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Hampton?
I am too busy. I got end of year tax stuff, and Bible.org donation calculations, and royalty calculations for all the journals and authors. And my least favorite time of the year is January.
Oh my goodness! Well, I hear you. I'm glad I'm not in that line of work. But in the midst of all that, are you excited for this?
I am. I like this book. So
me too. Me too. I like it. And I like going through the book of Daniel. How about if we start out with Daniel chapter 6? Although, you know, in chapter 5, we read that last time. And I often, you know, go back and listen to our podcast after you publish it. And something struck me as I just listened to it. And when Daniel gets on Belshazzar for, you know, drinking from the vessels from the temple, and he describes what happened with Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, "You did not humble yourself, even though you knew these things." You know what struck me when I heard that again was, that's Romans chapter 1.
That's true.
Right? Even though mankind knows these things, they suppress the truth and worship idols. Oh, it just sounded so much like that to me when I reread it. So I just wanted to point that out. So here we are in chapter 6.
This is a famous story.
Oh, boy, is it. I was listening to, oh boy, I bet you've never heard this song, Hampton, because it's a rap song.
Oh, I, speaking of songs, I was cooking dinner last night and with the guys, and I was playing a bunch of oldies, and Walk Away Renee came on.
Oh, that's such a fantastic song.
And I thought about you because you said that was one of your favorites.
Oh, it is. And, you know, I was listening to that song yesterday, too. Just driving down the road, you know, now with your phone, you can just be your own DJ. So I put on that song and I thought to myself, what is it about this song that I really like? And what I concluded was the violin in that song just stirs me. I don't know if there's a better instrument to stir the human heart than a violin.
Yeah.
And it's so good on that song. So anyway.
You were going to say something about another song?
Yeah. So it's
I rabbit trailed you.
Yeah. The artist.
Rabbit trailed the rabbit trail. So we're really in the woods.
So the artist is Flo Rida. You know, you might be tempted to say that Florida, but he breaks it up like a first name and a last name. And he's got this song, Good Feeling. And he mentions the lion's den in there. He mentions walking on water. he mentions some other stuff that are biblical images. So let's read about the lion's den.
Okay.
This is Daniel chapter 6. It seemed like a good idea to Darius to appoint over the kingdom 120 satraps who would be in charge of the entire kingdom. Over them would be three supervisors, one of whom was Daniel. These satraps were accountable to them so that the king's interests might not incur damage. Now this Daniel was distinguishing himself above the other supervisors and the satraps, for he had an extraordinary spirit. In fact, the king intended to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Consequently, the supervisors and satraps were trying to find some pretext against Daniel in connection with administrative matters, but they were unable to find any such damaging evidence because he was trustworthy and guilty of no negligence or corruption. So these men concluded, "We won't find any pretext against this man, Daniel, unless it is in connection with the law of his God." So these supervisors and satraps came by collusion to the king and said to him, "O King Darius, live forever." To all the supervisors of the kingdom, the prefects, satraps, counselors, and governors, it seemed like a good idea for a royal edict to be issued and an interdict to be enforced. For the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human other than you, O king, should be thrown into a den of lions. Now, let the king issue a written interdict so that it cannot be altered, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be changed. So King Darius issued the written interdict. When Daniel realized that a written decree had been issued, he entered his home, where the windows in his upper room opened toward Jerusalem. Three times daily he was kneeling and offering prayers and thanks to his God, just as he had been accustomed to do previously. Then those officials who had gone to the king came by collusion and found Daniel praying and asking for help before his God. So they approached the king and said to him, "Did you not issue an edict to the effect that for the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human other than to you, O king, would be thrown into a den of lions?" And the king replied, "That is correct. According to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be changed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who's one of the captives from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the edict that you issued. Three times daily he offers his prayer." When the king heard this, he was very upset and began thinking about how he might rescue Daniel. Until late afternoon, he was struggling to find a way to rescue him. Then those men came by collusion to the king and said to him, "Recall, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no edict or decree that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and Daniel was brought and thrown into a den of lions. The king consoled Daniel by saying, "Your God, whom you continually serve, will rescue you." Then a stone was brought and placed over the opening to the den. The king sealed it with his signet ring and with those of his nobles so that nothing could be changed with regard to Daniel. Then the king departed to his palace, but he spent the night without eating, and no diversions were brought to him. He was unable to sleep. In the morning, at the earliest sign of daylight, the king got up and rushed to the lion's den. As he approached the den, he called out to Daniel in a worried voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, was your God, whom you continually serve, able to rescue you from the lions?" Then Daniel spoke to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and closed the lions' mouths so that they have not harmed me, because I was found to be innocent before him. nor have I done any harm to you, O king. Then the king was delighted and gave an order to haul Daniel up from the den. So Daniel was hauled up out of the den. He had no injury of any kind because he had trusted in his God. The king gave another order, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and thrown into the lion's den. They, their children, and their wives. They did not even reach the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and language groups who were living in all the land, peace and prosperity. I've issued an edict that throughout all the dominion of my kingdom, people are to revere and fear the God of Daniel. For he is the living God. He endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His authority is forever. He rescues and delivers and performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel. Lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Any questions, Hampton?
Well, it just seemed interesting to me that he, Daniel, your God will rescue you. He knew he was the living God. Why'd he give that stupid order? don't pray to anybody but me.
And so, yes, and in the bigger picture, what's got to be happening historically is that Babylon found, the nation Babylon found out that Yahweh, the God of the Jews, is the real God. And now the Medes and Persians are finding out the same thing. Right. So even though God's people are held in captive, it's God that rules. It's his people that are the problem. It's not that Yahweh is weak.
Right.
So, yeah, great, great chapter. Okay, how about if you lead us on through Rodney Stark, how the West won.
Okay, so this is chapter 6 called Freedom and Capitalism.
This is an important one, Hampton.
Yeah, it's a
this
it's
is
a
big. Okay.
I'm going to start by just reading the second paragraph. I'll go ahead and read the first one. Compare Shakespeare's tragedies with those of the ancient Greeks. Not that Oedipus was without fault, but he did nothing to deserve his sad end. He simply fell victim to his destiny. In contrast, Othello, Brutus, Macbeth were not the captives of blind fate. As Cassius pointed out to Brutus, the fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. And in the end, each of these Shakespearean characters got what he or she deserved. One of the most important ideas facilitating the rise of the West is the belief in free will. Whereas most, if not all, ancient societies believed in fate, Westerners came to believe that humans are relatively free to follow the dictates of their conscience and that to a substantial degree, they make their own fate. This belief had remarkable behavioral consequences. Most important, perhaps, it created a tendency for people not to be resigned to things as they are, but rather to attempt to make the situation better. Moreover, belief in free will led directly to valuing the right of the individual to freely choose, with the result that medieval Europe rejected slavery, the only culture ever to have done so without external compulsion. Of course, eventually the West had to do it again in the New World. The value placed on individual freedom, combined with the legacy of Greek efforts at democracy, led to new democratic experiments in the medieval Italian city-states. Meanwhile, the rise of large monastic estates having extensive commercial activities led to the invention of capitalism and to the reformulation of theological doctrines in ways favorable to commerce. Subsequently, capitalism gained a firm footing in the newly democratic Italian city-states, transforming them into major centers of banking, trade, and even manufacturing. So one of the things that stands out in that paragraph to me is the contrast between the fatalistic attitude and doctrines of other religions like Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism.
Oh, yeah.
In contrast to Christianity.
That stands out starkly. So let me pose a question, because that's a huge issue. And I'll bet you remember taking classes like in theology proper on God's sovereignty and man's free will.
Right.
How did you reconcile that in your own thinking?
Well, I think that the Bible teaches both God's, you know, sovereignty, and even if you want to get into Calvinism, election. And at the same time, it teaches, you know, that we have choices and we have free will. And so I have tended to sit on the fence on that one and try not to fall off too far on either side.
Well, it's clear to me that the Bible teaches both. And I've never felt compulsion to understand everything. You know, I felt responsibility to try to the best of my ability to master the words of God, but not to be God. I don't know ultimately how that works. The way I simplistically did it in my mind is that both were true, but one was Trump. So, like, you know, that's how I worked out. So imagine you're playing cards and you play your eight of diamonds. Well, God can trump that, but you did play your eight of diamonds. You know, your actions were real. Your thoughts were real.
I've heard the illustration, when you get to the pearly gates, it's going to say, enter all who will. And then on the other side, it says, chosen before the foundation of the world.
Oh, I could see that easily. Yeah, I think that's good. So anyway, I didn't pay great attention in that class, because I came to that decision pretty early. And then the rest of it, you know, was people, you know, putting forth their defense of whatever they believed. And I thought, well, you're never going to be able to reconcile it,
right,
other than trusting in God. But that's a huge thing, because free will, you know, the oppressive governance removes free will. And if that's been removed from a culture for a long time, it's almost like, you know, remember those stories of like circus elephants that are chained, you know, in their place? They have a little bit of freedom to move, but not much. And then if they've grown up like that, when you take that chain off, they stay right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think cultures act like that. You know, we ran into that in Iraq when we thought, oh, we'll just change out their government. But those people aren't used to living like we do here. They don't respond to democracy the way we do.
Right.
So go ahead, read on, Hampton. This is a big subject.
On the next page, I have the idea of free will was not exclusive to Judeo-Christian heritage. The Roman philosopher Cicero expressed views somewhat similar to Augustine's. But for Jews and Christians, free will was not an obscure philosophical matter. Rather, it was the fundamental principle of their faith, without which the Ten Commandments were nonsense. I thought that was a really interesting and important, statement.
Yeah.
Thus, both Moses and Jesus taught that each individual must atone for moral lapses precisely because these are wrong choices. Being central to Jewish and Christian thought, the doctrine of free will called into question the legitimacy of social structures and customs that limited the individual's ability to choose freely, especially slavery and tyranny.
Yeah. So, you know, in those couple paragraphs, I have a word highlighted, and it's the word atone. And I think I mentioned this a couple podcasts back, but one of the books I've been reading lately is Who May Ascend to the Mount of the Lord. And in that book, it points out the structure of the Pentateuch. And I've told people for years, you know, that the structure of the documents we read in the Bible are very important to their contents. The Bible's not a novel, right? Read sequentially. It's highly structured. So in the middle of Moses's five books is the third book, which is Leviticus. And in the middle of Leviticus, so in other words, at the very heart of what we call the Pentateuch is the Day of Atonement. So that's a huge concept. We're not going to explore the entirety of that concept now, but I just wanted to point that out.
Right. Next section is the abolition of European slavery. And second paragraph says the historical record shows that slavery is far older than the pyramids and has been universal to all societies sufficiently affluent to afford it, including many aboriginal societies. The American Indians of the Northwest, for example, had extensive slavery long before the arrival of Columbus. Moreover, according to the U.S. State Department's annual report, as many as 27 million people around the world are exploited in modern slavery, most of them in Muslim nations and in Central Africa.
Yeah, there you go. That's good perspective.
Well,
right?
It is. And I think, you know, in our culture today, you know, it's always about how evil the Americans were with their slavery before the Civil War and all of that. Mm-hmm. But it's a widespread and it's still going on in Muslim countries. And I don't remember where I read it. I think it's in the section, but he said something about Islam has a problem with abolishing slavery because Muhammad had slaves. And so, you know,
yeah,
they can't condemn it.
Yeah, right.
Anything else stand out in that section about slaves?
No, just that broader perspective is good to have as you continue to read, but that's good.
Yeah, a little later on there, it goes, economics was not the decisive factor for getting rid of slaves. Slavery ended in medieval Europe only because the church extended its sacraments to all slaves and then banned the enslavement of Christians and Jews.
Yeah.
So when you start to, you know, Paul says there's no what Jew or Greek or slave or
yeah,
Greek.
Right.
You know, when you start, you know, reading the Bible, it's like, we shouldn't be doing this.
Well, that's right. And, you know, that raises another interesting question. Is Paul obviously, you know, existing in the Greco-Roman culture, was well aware of slavery. That was a prominent feature of that culture. And yet he didn't spend his efforts in like social reconstruction, right? He didn't think that was his main job to eradicate slavery from a culture. Right. His main job was to preach the gospel. And I wonder, I don't have any definite, you know, wisdom for any individual on how to approach that. But set your sights on God's scoreboard, not necessarily a culture's scoreboard. You know,
well, I think one reason he wouldn't condemn slavery and start a slave revolt is because that would have caused big problems for mm-hmm. the acceptance of Christianity.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't clean up your life before you believe in Jesus. You know, you get saved and then God cleans up your life.
Typically.
And so, yeah, typically. So, you know, they knew it would happen eventually if you started following the principles of scripture that would end slavery.
I think so. That's the way to go about it.
And see, next one is new democracies. That was the big section on Venice and Genoa democracies. And the thing that stood out to me was that they had very specific term limits. They would
yeah,
elect the
on their
leaders.
Yeah.
And they were not able to get reelected for a couple years in Venice.
Yeah.
And in Genoa. And they had to leave the state for a few years in one of those.
Yeah.
And everyone knew their leaders. They were local because they were all these little, cities.
Yeah.
And so they were, it seemed to me, they were very aware of the corruption that goes along with the power and did their best to stop it.
I think you're right. Those early, well, early compared to ours, but those early experiments in democracy are kind of interesting to read about. But I did have one thing I wanted to point out before that, Hampton. Sorry to jump in arrears, so to speak.
That's okay.
But they mention in this one paragraph, it reads like this: the doctrine that slaves were humans and not chattel had another important consequence: intermarriage. Despite being against the law in most of Europe, mixed unions seem to have been prevalent by the 7th century, usually involving free men and female slaves. So I have a question about that. You know what, once you read a certain passage in the scriptures and you get puzzled by it, mm-hmm. it tends to eat away at you until eventually you solve it. I've had four or five of those I can think of off the top of my head that keep me awake at night for decades, literally. So I've often wondered, back to Daniel chapter 2, in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, it describes iron mixed with clay. And Stark used that term, not that he's necessarily a biblical thinker as he's writing this, but he used that term to describe marriage between slaves and free people. Is that what's behind the iron and clay mixture in Daniel 2? I don't know,
yeah,
but it just struck me as something to think through. So you can carry on. I'm sorry I
oh, that's
interrupted
fine.
You. But
that's good. well, anyway, that was the section with new democracies about Venice and Genoa. And that was the main thing that stood out to me in that,
mm-hmm.
the term limits. And
how
our society today and our
the
people in power for 40 years and how corrupt
Fauci's been there for most of his adult life, and he's now approaching his 80s.
Yeah.
But I have a funny, so what is the leader in Venice called? Like their president, do you remember that name, that title for their head official?
Area? Is that the one?
No, the Doge. The D-O-G-E.
Oh, okay.
I just thought that's such a fun name, the Doge.
Yeah.
So carry on.
Inventing capitalism is the next section.
Yeah.
And he starts off saying probably every leading textbook in introductory sociology gives substantial positive coverage to Max Weber's famous thesis that Protestants invented capitalism, as he claimed in his Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism in 1904. But it isn't so, he says. The rise
of the social imaginary again.
There you go. Well, you heard the Protestant work ethic.
Oh, sure.
That's the phrase. It's not the Christian work ethic. It's the Protestant work ethic.
Okay.
And now it's the white supremacy work ethic, I think.
Yeah.
So the rise of capitalism in Europe preceded the Reformation by centuries. So it might more accurately be called the Christian work ethic.
Very good.
Because he goes on to say that, they started using cash instead of barter, the monks in the monasteries. It was easier to sell your wine or your goods and then go buy things with your money than to be hauling stuff around. And how do you trade something that came ripe in a certain time with somebody that doesn't come ripe until later?
Mm-hmm.
And so then he says that once the monks were freed up from working in the fields, that they could spend more time in liturgical work, in learning, and in economics, and in science. You remember when we were reading Evolution's Achilles Heels and talking about genetics?
Yeah, right.
Mendel?
Right.
Wasn't he a monk?
Yes, Gregor Mendel.
Yeah. And maybe this also enabled them to have more time to copy manuscripts.
Oh boy, that just gives me horrors of my, you know, of what's that class? You know, textual transmission.
Textual criticism.
Textual criticism. Oh my gosh, what a subject! What a worthy one to study, though, because you come away from that so convinced of the solidity of the Christian documents. But it's a difficult study. But how about this sentence, Stark's sentence, second paragraph, the first sentence after inventing capitalism: why my fellow sociologists persist in embracing Weber's thesis can only be attributed to historical ignorance. The reason I wanted to read that is because when we're listening to subjects that are not our main field of study, we tend to just accept what's said by scholars because that's not our field, right? Well, they know more than we do, so surely if they're saying X, it must be X. That's not necessarily the case at all.
Right. Well, I think that's the thing that struck me about this book on the whole, is that he goes through and challenges these kinds of false beliefs, and then he has a lot of good support.
Right. Know. Right. So I just wanted to encourage our listeners to be diligent in their homework.
Right.
So
anything else in that section?
Well, we're going to move on capitalism, right? Because I want to get to that definition. That's important.
On capitalism. I'm trying to find that.
It's just barely ahead.
Oh, there it is. Okay, go ahead.
So we're going to read his definition of capitalism. But before we do, usually I think it's helpful for people to try and define it in their own mind. That way, when you hear the good definition, you know, it'll strike you harder. So think through what elements would be included in a good definition of capitalism.
And I would want to have private ownership of property, the capital.
Oh, very good.
In there.
Very good. It may be something about freedom.
Right.
Okay, so let's read it, because this is a comprehensive definition. So here's his definition of capitalism. Capitalism is an economic system wherein privately owned, relatively well-organized, and stable firms pursue complex commercial activities within a relatively free, that is, unregulated market, taking a systematic long-term approach to investing and reinvesting wealth directly or indirectly in productive activities involving a hired workforce and guided by anticipated and actual returns. It's good. It's comprehensive. It might be a little bulky. You know, it'd be hard to carry around that definition in your mind, I think. But the two key components, well, three, maybe. Privately owned and, possession of stuff and free market.
Well, you know what stood out to me was the unregulated.
Yeah, that's what he means by free.
And I think, you know, when you look back at when Trump took over and he pretty much went in and started, I think he had some rule for every new regulation, you got to get rid of four or something like that, or two. I
don't and know the economy takes off like a rocket ship.
And the economy just, you know, really soared after he did that.
Right. Right. That's been just known forever. The reason some, persuasions of politics regulate an economy like the US, it's not to help the average citizen. It's to do favors for their buddies,
Right.
right? It's to
It's for
punish
gaining
some,
more power and
it's for
control.
gaining more power and control, punishing some, elevating others, usually their friends, right? It had nothing to do with, the health of the market on its own, which benefits everybody.
Yeah.
So go
See what
ahead.
else in that section stood out.
Well, he has a short summary, right? He goes on for paragraphs to explain that definition, but he has a good one sentence buttress of his definition. Capitalism rests on free markets, secure property rights, and free labor. There you go.
Right.
If you actually think what force in history has had the power to raise many, many, many millions of people out of poverty, it's capitalism that's done that.
Yeah, I don't know. We read this earlier or some other place, but social, or maybe I just heard it. Socialism has never built a country. It's always basically taken over the country and then gone downhill after that.
Right. So then his next section is Christianity and the rise of capitalism. So how did Christianity influence that economic power, which has lifted, like I said, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty? What was Christianity's influence on that? So let's read that. Let me read just a little bit because I want to raise a biblical question here. So
Okay.
the first two sentences under the heading Christianity and the Rise of Capitalism. Why have so many scholars overlooked Christianity's influence on the rise of capitalism? Let's pause there. Why do you think that's the case that scholars overlook that?
Well, just besides the fact that most people don't, that if you're not Christian, you don't want to give credit to Christianity.
Well, that's right. They don't want Christianity to look like the hero that's raised hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. They're atheists primarily, right?
Right.
Why would some silly religion be responsible for such a good thing? So they just don't they don't answer the question correctly because of their worldview. And remember what we've said about worldview. The very first thing a person will do for their worldview is lie.
Right.
So in this case, and I don't think it's even malicious, I don't think they sit there and, oh, let's deceive everybody. It's not part of their worldview. So they skew their presentation of the facts. So anyway, the second sentence is one reason may be that the Bible often condemns greed and wealth. Would now pause there,
I don't think
because
it condemns wealth.
I was going to say that straight out. Well, where? What Bible's he reading?
Right.
You can tell he's a sociologist and not a biblical scholar. However, that's
Well, I
an
think
important point.
that even gives more credence to his views here, I think, because he's recognizing historical facts
Yeah,
and
he has no motive to favor
right.
Christianity, in other words,
It
and yet he
doesn't seem
is.
like it.
Yeah. So think of some of the prominent biblical characters. They were very wealthy
Like
people.
Solomon.
So, yeah, the richest guy ever, according to right the standards of the day. And Boaz was a tremendous guy and
Right.
was very wealthy. Job was very wealthy. Abraham, very wealthy. David, fabulously wealthy. Right? So it doesn't, condemn wealth. And the verse,
it's more about how you use that wealth.
That's exactly right. Well, think about that. I've always thought about money this way. Money's neither here nor there. What money is a window into your soul. If you have money, how are you going to use it? If you don't have money, how are you going to handle that?
Right.
See what I mean? It's not, it just reveals what's already inside of you. So, yeah. But here's the verse that he quotes in support of, of his view, right? 1 Timothy 6:10, for the love of money is the root of all evil. You notice anything about just that quote?
Well, he left out all sorts of evil.
Okay. And so he puts the definite article, right? For the love of money is the root of all evil.
Oh, is it a root?
It's in the Greek text. There's no definite article there.
Interesting.
So, which would make sense, right? Now, money's not the root of all evil. Of course, Paul didn't say that. But yes, it can be a root of evil, right? But it's not. I mean, if you had to attribute the root of all evil, I mean, you might pick something like pride or something like that. But it, you know, and money can reflect that. But right. There are much deeper things than money in the scriptures. So anyway, you can tell he's not a biblical scholar. But a worthy read, nonetheless.
Right. Very good. So, what else? Anything else in that section?
Well, he's going to get to Deuteronomy. But there's some interesting, you know, developments along the way of a society. Like when you start investing capital and the idea of credit, right, and so on, how a culture can thrive, how an economy can thrive. You know, those are important things. I don't want to detail those all out for our listeners, but those are important things to have a concept of in your working mind of an economy. the value of that. So I used to, with my daughter, she was growing up, she's out in the workforce now, but as she was growing up, when it would be election time, I would make her watch, you know, the debates with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, now we're just going to sit here and watch this, no talking, you know, so for a couple hours, you just got to pay attention. And then we'll talk about it afterwards. So that's what we would do. And then I would just point out, you know, when that particular debate was over, the economic points that came up in the debate or the discussion, and just, you know, show the flaws in them. Right. But they're really just trying to smooth people's feathers. They're not really giving sharp economic analysis. And mostly they're just blaming the other guy.
Yeah.
Right. So I tried to get her to think through those things. And the way you have to think through them is you have to fundamentally understand what an economy is and how that works, what the role of taxation is, and so on. Then you can vote intelligently. Although these days, Hampton, voting doesn't even matter in the U.S., right? Not on a national, federal level, maybe on certain state and local level, but not on a national
level. Unless you're in Arizona.
Oh, gosh. Don't rabbit trail.
Okay. The virtue of work is the next section. And he said that, you know, notions of the dignity of labor were incomprehensible in ancient Rome and any other pre-capitalist society. You know, the rich people didn't want to work. And in China, they grew their fingernails really long to show that they, you know,
didn't work.
I thought that was kind of interesting. I had never thought of that.
Yeah.
But in a capitalist society, you know, work is honorable, and, you know, you get to keep the fruit of your labor and sell it, trade it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened long before Martin Luther was born. So hence his dispute of the Protestant work ethic.
Right. Right. Yeah. So he just flat out says, you know, in that section, Weber. So, you know, the famous German sociologist, Max Weber, and they would say Weber, I'm sure, but was wrong.
Yeah.
That's a simple sentence, but Weber was wrong. But you got to study to know that he was wrong.
Yeah. He also, the next section was about a theological revolution. And
yeah.
The topic there was the idea of usury or charging interest.
Mm-hmm.
I think of usury as charging too much interest.
Yeah.
But
me too.
But the Bible does tell the Jews, Israelites, to not charge interest to their fellow Israelites. And so people had come to the conclusion that any interest anywhere was wrong.
And yeah.
Over this time period, they kind of changed their mind on that and figured out that the Bible really wasn't condemning all interest, but the abuse, maybe.
Right. So let me jump in there real quick, because this is more biblical stuff. I like to, whenever we can, strengthen our listeners' biblical views. So, for instance, we talked earlier about the structure of the Pentateuch being five books and what would be the very center of that. But the last book of the Pentateuch, the reason I'm going into that is he cites Deuteronomy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says the church had long opposed charging interest, a position inherited from the Jews. The basis for this doctrine was the Old Testament passage, Deuteronomy 23:19 through 20, which admonishes you shall not charge interest on loans, and so on. So I can't imagine that Stark is aware of this, but I'm going to tell a little bit of a story about that. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ETS meetings a few years ago, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, was in San Diego. And I remember running into, you know, one of our favorite authors there, Eugene Merrill. We cite him often, right? So he was one of my teachers in school. I'm sure one of yours. And so, you know, we began talking, and I said, Dr. Merrill, you know, I've got a daughter. So at that time, you know, Sophia was maybe 15, 16, somewhere in there. And I said, you know, if you ask my daughter what the book of Deuteronomy is, she'll tell you that it's a suzerain vassal treaty and and that it has seven sections. And the first section is the preamble. And this is standard stuff in the ancient Near East. You know, these treaties really held to form, you know, where like Nebuchadnezzar, after he kicked your butt, right, would make you sign a treaty. And I'm going to protect you, but you're going to pay me taxes, blah, blah, blah. This is how our relationship's going to go. These are the laws I want you guys to abide by. So God adopts that form in the book of Deuteronomy. That's how he addresses Israel, is as their sovereign king. So right. There's a preamble, and that's clear in Deuteronomy, first five verses. Then there's a historical prologue, you know, basically the first four chapters, in which God will say, here's how we got to this point. I rescued you out of Egypt. I'm the guy that provided for you along the way, and so on. Then you get the general stipulations. Here's the general rules, and we know those as the Ten Commandments. Then you get the specific stipulations, and that makes up most of the book of Deuteronomy. And then you get the blessings and the curses, right? If you obey me, here's how good it's going to go for you. And if you don't, here's what's going to happen. And that's like three chapters long, right? And then you get the witnesses. OK, Okay. And in Deuteronomy, who's going to witness the deal between Israel and their God? Well, it's all creation. So the sun, the moon, the stars are the witnesses to what's going down between those parties. Now, here's a further interesting fact about that. Remember, you have the general stipulations. We know that as the Ten Commandments. Then you have the specific stipulations. Now, in that section, the specific stipulations, essentially what you're getting is the expansion of the Ten Commandments. So don't murder. Okay, we got that. Well, how does that apply? You know, if a guy breaks into your house in the middle of the night, can you defend yourself? Or how does that apply in war? Or there's other scenarios, right? So that's what you're getting in the specific stipulations is how to apply the general rule, don't murder. So what section of the what commandment would the section on don't charge interest fall under, do you think? Which commandment are they elucidating?
I don't know.
Don't steal.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah.
So once you see that layout of the book, the sections just read so much more clearly. So,
Right.
but that's all because you would do your study and find out, you know, in the comparative materials around the Old Testament that, oh, there's this thing called a suzerain vassal treaty. And Deuteronomy is not that literally word for word, but it very much has those sections. It very much should be read in light of that. So anyway, back to Merrill, when I told him that's how my daughter would answer that question if you asked her what the book of Deuteronomy is. And a little tear trickled down his eye. And he goes, oh, I wish more people. He goes, we have doctoral students that can't answer that question. And I'm thinking, well, who were their teachers? I mean, that's pretty basic stuff. But anyway, that's what that is. I wanted to detour there because that's important for our listeners to know when they're reading Deuteronomy, that they have that layout in their mind.
Right. He did quote Luke 6:34. It says, Jesus says, if you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return.
Yeah, no question. I mean,
So that was,
that's true.
those kinds of statements made people think I can't charge interest.
Yeah, and I'd say that's a misapplication of that. You know, I used to do this with some students. I used to go to the whiteboard and I'd write, make two categories. And I just wouldn't fill them out yet. But in one category, I would have the heading money. And then in the other category, I would have the heading God. And then I'd say to the students, okay, list everything that you think money is for. And, you know, it would take us 5, 10 minutes. And we'd do that. And then I said, okay, now tell me what you think God is for. And I'll tell you, those lists look awfully close. They're almost word for word. And so I said, you see how easy it is to confuse those two. And that's what I think the Bible's driving at, right? Don't confuse money with God.
Can't serve God and money.
Get right. Those are in many ways rival powers. But
Right.
so anyway, carry on.
Well, he said later on in that section that no later than the 13th century, the leading Christian theologians had fully debated the primary aspects of emerging capitalism: profits, property rights, credit, lending, and the like. And in each, it says, as the historian Lester K. Little summed up, in each case, they came up with generally favorable, approving views in sharp contrast to the attitudes that had prevailed for 6 or 7 centuries, right up to the previous generation. Capitalism was freed from all fetters of faith.
Very good.
Then he has the next section, capitalist city-states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he goes through the Italian stuff.
Yeah, he has, the last paragraph says, the proximate cause of the rise of Italian capitalism was freedom from the rapacious rulers who repressed and consumed economic progress in most of the world, including most of Europe. Although their political life often was turbulent, these city-states were true republics able to sustain the freedom capitalism requires. Second, centuries of technological progress had laid the necessary foundations for the rise of capitalism, especially the agricultural surpluses needed to sustain cities and to permit specialization. In addition, Christian theology encouraged the idea of progress, which justified long-term investment strategies and provided moral justifications for the business practices fundamental to capitalism.
Yeah, very good.
And his last two short sentences here, our paragraphs, the freedom factor. Mm-hmm. If there is a single factor responsible for the rise of the West, it is freedom. Freedom to hope, freedom to act, freedom to invest, freedom to enjoy the fruits of one's dreams, as well as one's labor. So much of that freedom emerged during the so-called Dark Ages. The ramifications would be felt for centuries to come.
Well, there you go. So freedom coupled with, you know, private ownership is the way to go. That will free your populace economically. It'll empower them. And to govern in any other way will oppress them. So the large question, you know, how the West won. They won by approximating more closely biblical principles than the East did. That's how they won. But the West was crumbling, has crumbled, I would say.
Yeah.
Right? That maybe it's the love of money got them.
Perhaps.
Perhaps, but that's a good section. So understanding the fundamentals of capitalism and how that created success for the common man, that's important to think through.
It is. Well, that was good.
Thank you very much, Hampton.
Yeah, I'll talk to you next time.
Great. Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing and perfect.